About 10:30 yesterday morning, that's March 25, I received a text message from Friends of the Earth Melbourne about a Frontline Climate Alliance meeting, online meeting, at midday. Understanding that the guests would be Dan Cowdell and Karina Donkers from Geelong Sustainability, I decided to attend. Dan Cowdell is the CEO of Geelong Sustainability, and he has been a guest on Climate Conversations, for which you'll find a link in the show notes, and Karina Donkers is the program coordinator. By chance, I ended up in a breakout room with Dave from Melbourne and Karina, but more about that later. This is the latest episode of Climate Conversations. Welcome, it's so great to have you on board. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. It was in the breakout room that I told Dave and Karina that I once worked for the dark side as a teenager in Bass Strait, doing seismic testing the length and breadth of Bass Strait with the Western Geophysical Company of America, whom was working for, I understand, ESSO. I was about 16 or 17 at the time, and had no idea what I was doing, and that's probably 60 years ago. When our work finished in Bass Strait, we moved to Western Australia. I worked up the West Australian coast, all around Barrow Island, of course, then the Arafura Sea across the top of Australia, and finally, for me at least, in the Gulf of Papua at Papua New Guinea, and of course the associated rivers. I had spent some time in Broome in Western Australia, back in the days when Broome was simply a tiny, tiny town. Bass Strait was then, and still is, among the wildest pieces of water in the world, and we worked on small boats. In imperial terms, our boat was only about 200 feet long, and there were two of them. One was a shooting boat, and the other was a recording boat. I worked primarily on the recording boat. On an open back deck, there was no rail between me and the ocean. One of my tasks was to guide out a probably a mile-long cable and fit flotation devices to it every so often. Again, no protection, no life jackets, no safety harness, nothing. And sometimes water coming over the back deck would be neck height, because to reel in the cable, the boat had to reverse, and it meant reversing into, sometimes, waves over which you could not see. In fact, the waves were sometimes so high that you couldn't even see the shooting boat, as it was called, and it was only half a kilometre away. Yes, it was the Wild West. Health and safety would be so alarmed, you could never do it today. But I survived, although I did see a number of people go overboard, and within minutes they were virtually out of sight. But we did manage to recover them. Of course, as a recording boat, it was the place where the explosive charges were put together, anything from 25 pound to 500 pound. And every so often, at predetermined times, I had to push the charge off the back of the boat, and sometimes the charge would be as much as 500 pounds, sometimes only 25 pounds. And of course, we could hear when the shooting boat was ready to ignite the charge, and sometimes the charge was still on the back of the boat before we actually got to push it over the edge. And it's pretty alarming when you know that all you need is somebody on the shooting boat, as it's called, to press the appropriate button and the charge ignites, destroying the boat and everybody on it. But that never happened for me, fortunately, although I did hear that it happened on a couple of occasions when the shooting boat set the charge off far too soon and destroyed everything. The boat was gone. The people were dead. But as I said, that didn't happen to me, fortunately. I went to Barrow Island just off the West Australian coast in the early to mid-60s to take supplies or help take supplies to a fellow who was based there providing the Western Geophysical Company with navigation services. Beyond that fellow and the usual wildlife, there was nothing else there. Today it is home to the Gorgon LNG plant, a massive project. I worked for the survey company that did all the seismic testing for the gas fields developed around Barrow Island. Although my role was tiny and insignificant, I feel vaguely guilty. Now we have a story from the Melbourne Age by Mike Foley. It has the headline, Energy Shortage Fears Prompt Minister to Pump Up New Gas Projects. Let's listen to the audio from that story.
Resources Minister Madeleine King says new gas projects can help plug shortfalls in New South Wales and Victoria after a warning the states face supply deficits sooner than first thought. Shortfalls could hit the southern gas market of Victoria, New South Wales, South Australia and Tasmania from 2026, a year earlier than the energy grid operator had forecast last year. The Australian energy market operator, AEMO, warned that the entire East Coast market would be in yearly supply deficit by 2028 unless more gas flowed. The Albanese government will this week introduce reforms to the Commonwealth assessment regime for offshore gas projects, which it said would clarify consultation requirements for developers. However, the Greens warned the reforms also enable the resources minister to effectively bypass environmental assessment in approving projects. But following an intervention from Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek, the government announced on Monday amendments that would ensure the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act cannot be sidelined. AEMO identified three options for addressing the future shortages: new gas fields be opened in the south to supplement shrinking supplies from Queensland, import terminals be built to ship in liquefied gas from other states or overseas, and new domestic supply pipelines be built. King opened consultation on her future gas strategy last year, which she said would manage the transition away from fossil fuels to reach net zero emissions by 2050, while delivering enough gas to ensure Australia's energy security and affordability for customers. It is expected to be released by the middle of this year. Reasonably priced sources of gas are what is needed to shore up East Coast gas supply, King said. Both the AEMO and ACCC have called for new supply, and the work we are doing in the future gas strategy is looking at the options. Gas is a potentially explosive issue for the government. Labor's right flank backs Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, who says gas has a key role in the energy transition, and manufacturers and workers' unions warn the lack of supply is driving up gas prices and is risking imminent closure at industrial plants. But Labor's green-tinged left opposes new gas projects and is pushing to speed up the fuel source's demise. King said last year that the future gas strategy must ensure Australia's gas production did not slip below the demand, which would cause supply disruptions and high prices. "We need to ensure gas demand decreases faster than supply through the energy transition," she said in October. Australia is one of the world's biggest gas producers, but southern states are heavily reliant on interstate supplies. New South Wales does not produce any gas, and Victoria relies on dwindling supply from its Bass Strait fields. King said New South Wales and Victoria's best solution is to open new gas fields. "The most efficient and carbon-conscious means of accessing gas needed for the transition to net zero is to extract it closer to the places where it is needed. Both states rely on Queensland gas fields, but producers cannot simply ramp up domestic supply because they are locked into long-term export contracts into Asia. That's why private companies want to develop gas import terminals, which could ship liquefied gas to the East Coast from Western Australia, Queensland, or the international market." Another complicating factor for New South Wales and Victoria is that the interstate gas pipeline network is running at capacity, so even if Queensland increased its supply, it may not be available for the southern states. King said import terminals may be an option if they are commercially viable. "Projects are in development in New South Wales and Victoria, but the proponents have yet to demonstrate a viable business model." Squadron Energy, part of Andrew Forrest's Tattarang Group, is building what could become Australia's first terminal capable of receiving LNG. Squadron says construction is 90% complete, but it has so far been unable to sign off-take agreements with gas suppliers or electricity generators, which are crucial to its business model. Viva Energy is proposing LNG imports at the site of its Geelong oil refinery, but a final investment decision on the project has been stalled by the approvals process, including the state government's assessment of environmental impacts. If gas that has been liquefied, shipped and delivered via an LNG import terminal can be cost competitive with pipeline gas, then it could play a role in our energy mix, King said. Opposition Resources spokesperson Susan McDonald said the government had failed to boost gas supply despite repeated warnings from AEMO. Last year's gas forecasts had East Coast shortfalls in 2027, and thanks to Labor's abject failures, this forecast supply cliff has been brought forward to 2026, McDonald said.
The climate debate, in all its forms, still goes on in the US. Let's listen to this.
The passage of the Inflation Reduction Act in the U.S. has spurred a huge amount of investment and progress in the renewable energy space. And at the same time, a big uptick in anti-renewables activism, especially when it comes to offshore wind projects. In a lot of cases, the people showing up to fight wind farms, both on land and offshore, are the same people who were fighting them over a decade ago. But there are some new groups too, and they're deploying some new tactics, especially around conservation and the idea that wind turbines are bad for birds and whales. There's no science backing up these claims, but that hasn't stopped them from taking hold. Still, it's a tricky situation. We're not just talking about fossil fuel-backed resistance here. The groups opposing these projects are not just AstroTurf groups. Some of them are real grassroots groups comprised of citizens who are genuinely concerned about, for example, the fate of the endangered right whale and how offshore wind farms might impact it. Many of those groups are being co-opted and weaponized, though, by organizations that have spent the past 20 years working to block climate policy. And then the whole issue is complicated even further by the fact that some of the companies building these wind farms either are today or used to be fossil fuel companies. It's complicated, which is why a report out of Brown University late last year mapping the groups that are active on the East Coast of the U.S. was especially helpful. That report is called Against the Wind, and it digs into the people and organizations who are actively fighting wind energy. It looks at how they connect to each other, who's funding what, and which talking points seem to be spreading. To unpack it all, I've got Isaac Slevin, the lead author on the report, with me today. I'm Amy Westervelt, and this is Drilled. After the break, a deep dive on the fight over wind. Stay with us.
You'll find the link for the Drilled podcast in the show notes under a story headlined, "The Atmosphere Doesn't Care About Your Feelings." Next, we have the opening segment of the documentary, "When Heat Kills, The Effects of Climate Change on Workers."
Scientists have warned that rising global temperatures will increase the risk of people suffering heat stress. It's already a big issue for those who work outside.
Ce sera donc l'une des journées, peut-être la journée la plus chaude de toute notre histoire. Une chaleur qui s'étale, se répand.
Les climatologues expliquent que l'été 2022 deviendra la norme.
Beneath the scorching sun, two peasants take a break while working a field. It's hard, hot work. The pastoral setting makes an obvious point. Heat and work never did mix well. When Van Gogh painted this work in 1889, the world had already unconsciously started a new climate age. The age of unprecedented global warming. The most recent years have been the warmest that have ever been on record. Climate change is threatening the health of millions of workers who are directly exposed to the heat. What's more, it reduces their productivity and brings into question the conventional model of growth, to always produce more, faster. The warming climate is reaching an insurmountable limit, the bounds set by the human body. Can we keep working as we always have in a hotter world? And at what price?
Let's listen now to Anjali Sharma. She's on TEDx Youth Sydney. Anjali sued the government and was fighting for a climate-safe future for her and her counterparts when she was just 16. Let's listen now to the TEDx talk.
At the age of 16, I sued the government. I was the lead litigant in the Sharma and Minister for the Environment class action, which took the then Environment Minister, Susan Lee, to court, arguing that she owed and was breaching a duty of care to young people to protect us from the impacts of climate change. On first instance, we won and changed climate law. But then Susan Lee appealed, and before a higher court, our case was overturned. Now, I promise I'm not saying this for clout, but to make sure that everyone here knows that I know what I'm talking about. After all, these are big kid conversations in which young people, like us, are constantly told that we have no place. On one hand, we're urged to be the change we want to see in the world, but when it comes to advocacy, we're put in a box. There are firm limits on what we can and can't say. We can't be too radical. We must focus on individual responsibility, and no matter what we say, it cannot challenge those in power. Let them talk about emissions reductions and fossil fuels while we talk about shorter showers and plastic straws. Let them make the big decisions for the world while we keep our heads down. We're put in a box. We can talk about climate change, sure, but we mustn't point the finger at those in power. At the age of 12, I was in this box. July through to September 2017 saw widespread flooding in my home country of India, where much of my family still lives. Experts called it the worst in decades, with more than 45 million people affected. On one hand, I was seeing those I loved be devastated by the reality of climate change, and on the other, my school implored me to focus on recycling and taking shorter showers. I was outraged, and I wanted to make a difference. And I thought I was, by following their lead and speaking up and criticizing surface-level issues like plastic straws. I thought my education was empowering me, but it was cementing me inside this box. Now, at the age of 14, I was seeing more and more climate disaster around me. 2019 saw the heaviest monsoon in 25 years make landfall on the shores of India, bringing with it once again widespread flooding and devastation. But it was at our shores too, in the form of the horrific 2019 bushfire season that didn't leave a single soul in this country untouched. But it was something within me that had changed at this point. I'd been watching YouTube videos, documentaries, I'd been surrounding myself with like-minded people. And I'd begun to hear about climate wreckers such as Woodside, Rio Tinto, Santos, the fossil fuel donors that every day overtly influence our politicians to do their bidding, day in, day out. And again, I was outraged, and I was struggling to reconcile facts like this with the reality of the climate crisis that I saw unfolding before my eyes. So I joined School Strike for Climate. And in 2019, I led 200,000 people through the streets of Melbourne as we called on our government to increase their climate ambition. But I was realizing that somewhere along the way, what had started off as supportive nods at the age of 12 had turned into disapproving remarks as we grew in number and noise and people asked us, "Who do you think you are to be telling the government what to do? What do you even know?" They wanted us firmly back in that box. But I was armed now with knowledge, with passion, with ambition, and I wanted firmly out. I wanted to make more noise. At the age of 12, I'd been pointing the finger at myself and at everyone around me. At the age of 14, I'd finally placed responsibility on the government. And at the age of 16, I was ready to do this in a public forum where I was sure they couldn't ignore me any longer. So when I was asked to be part of a class action that had the potential to make new law, I had no second thoughts about saying yes. Suddenly, I was thrust into the public spotlight, but this is where criticism was at its loudest and its worst. Because my advocacy was no longer palatable. I wasn't in that box. I was a 16-year-old woman of color who, instead of just talking about climate change, was taking the government to court. Racism, sexism, threats, hate, these were part and parcel now of daily life. So I told myself that what I was doing was finally a threat to those in power. And of course, there were people who wouldn't like it. Of course, they would make it known, and I soldiered on. But I can't lie, it was devastating to realize that in a group of 8 plaintiffs who had sued the government together, there was only one towards whom hate and vitriol to this extent was being directed. It was the one person of color, of course. It was me. People were outraged as is because of what we were doing, but they were more outraged because of who I was. It was my identity itself that was the challenge. That was the box. I've realized now that breaking out of this box as a young woman of color brings with it criticism, sure, but it also brings impact. Because for the first time, people were watching as I talked about the hypocrisy of a government that even now pretends to care about the climate crisis while funneling through fossil fuel approvals regardless. People were listening as I talked about the disproportionate impacts of the climate crisis on frontline communities like my own in India, those who were and are being hit first and worst with the least resources to rebuild. And even though the federal court overturned our case on appeal, the climate science that we put to the court on both instances was accepted. It'll now form the basis for more cases like mine. I went from a 12-year-old who thought that if we all just turned off the tap while brushing our teeth, then we could all save the environment together. I stand before you now, a 19-year-old who knows that if we are to have any sort of concrete impact, then our attention must be focused on those in power and that we cannot keep living in this box. The world is going to tell us that we're young, that we're idealistic, that we're naive. The world is going to tell us that we don't have all of the answers, or any of them, really. The world is going to tell us what to say, when to say it, exactly how loud. And the world is going to tell us to pipe down. The world is going to tell us to get back in this box. We don't have to accept that. We must not accept that. We cannot keep living in this box. We cannot keep justifying, taking directions on how to advocate from those we should be advocating against. Because young people don't have all the answers. We don't. We don't know everything. But the one thing we do have is skin in the game. We have stakes in this conversation. This is our future. We have a reason to continue to insert ourselves into difficult conversations, conversations where we're told we don't know what we're talking about, because this is our future. We have a reason to continue to stare up to those in power, look them in the eyes, and tell them, you don't get to decide what my future looks like. I do.
I mentioned earlier when working in Bass Strait that the Western Geophysical Company was employed by ESO, Well, Esso was about somewhere, but really it was Woodside. And at the time, I was told Woodside shares were 5 cents each. They're now worth $30 or $40. You can imagine why I went and worked with the Western Geophysical Company of America. At the time, I was a cadet journalist in Echuca, earning £11 a week. My older sister, she was 7 years older than me, became involved with a fellow from the Western Geophysical Company of America, and he was employed as a shooter. That seemed really romantic to me, and he told stories of travelling around the world with the Western Geophysical Company of America, and the excitement of being a shooter. As I said, I was earning £11 a week, and he said, come and join the company, and you'll get £100 a week, all expenses paid. I couldn't resist the offer. The adventure, the pay, and the chance to do something different. So I joined the company. Had I known then what I know now, I wouldn't have gone near the company, for they are the villains of the climate crisis. I should thank Karina Donkers, because without her encouragement, I wouldn't have talked much about what happened in Bass Strait, what happened up the West Australian coast, and what happened in New Guinea. So thank you, Karina. Well, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It's been great with you along. And my screen is still alive with stories about the climate crisis. So I'll put as many as I can in the show notes. So go there, read them, and check them out. Also, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast. So contact me at r.mclean7@icloud.com. And please, at the same time, tell me how you feel about this podcast. Good or bad, don't hold back. Please let me know. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now take care and stay safe. And my 76-year-old voice is failing me. Well, it's become very croaky. It's not failing me, it's just become croaky. So I hope it's not offensive. Yes, I always forget something. Put this on your networks, share it with your friends, let people know what's going on with the climate crisis. We need everybody, because to change everything, we need everyone. Now take care.